There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine, to start with, is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know? It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to podcast number 49, the second of our four December programs. This show features Brooke Williams of Zaca Mesa Wines in Santa Barbara County, California. This podcast is sponsored by Waterford Wine. Find them on the web at waterfordwine.com.
To look at a map of the coast of California, you'll notice the mountains follow the curve of the state, which of course is logical, except for the Santa Ynez Valley, where the mountains stretch inland as the coast cuts away near Santa Barbara. That means different effects of fog and climate. Zaca Mesa is found in the Santa Ynez Valley, where Brooke Williams is the president and CEO, as well as wine grower. Brooke visited Milwaukee in late summer of this year and stopped at our studio to talk about Zaca Mesa and the amazing wines of Santa Ynez. Well, I'm here with Brooke William of Zaca Mesa Winery, correct?
Correct.
And we're here at the studio talking for a change. So welcome to Milwaukee. I understand you've been here before.
Been here a couple times.
So you've seen the evolution of this state go from obviously a heavy-duty beer state to people are drinking a lot of wine here now.
People are drinking wine, which is great. And it doesn't matter the type of wine, people are drinking wine and getting embracing the grape culture. And it's fun. It's exciting.
It's a heck of a lot of fun. It's certainly exciting for you as well, considering you're a couple of thousand miles away, to be able to come to a place like this and to be able to sell what you got.
Exactly.
And how long have you been in Wisconsin?
I've been here for less than an hour.
But I'm pup. Thank you very much. No, I mean, how long has your wine been available in Wisconsin?
Good question. Probably a good 25, 30 years.
Okay, so you've definitely got some history behind you.
We've been around since 73, so that's 38 years, and it took us a while to get this far east.
Wow, I was in high school back then, but we don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, to get serious here for a moment, Zaca Mesa, we were briefly talking about the name, and you're in Los Olivos, correct?
Los Olivos, yes.
And that's in Santa Barbara County.
Yep, in the Santa Ynez Valley.
Okay, and that's where the mountains kind of go a different direction. You got to get a lot of cool air coming in there.
It's the only place from Alaska to Patagonia that has what they call the transverse mountains. So it's a mountain range that goes east-west. The rest of the whole Pacific Ocean is usually bordered with a mountain range going north-south along the ocean. So we get a lot of ocean influence. And what's great about the Santa Ynez Valley is we're 30 miles inland, but we're still a relatively cool, mild area. And the valley is great because at one end of the valley, you have Santa Rita Hills, which is great for Pinot. We're kind of in the middle of the valley, Syrah, some Chardonnay, some other things going on there. And then you get further out the valley and it warms up as you get further inland. And then you got Sauvignon Blanc and Cab Franc. People are playing with those things out there. And it's really fun to see that evolution within the area. And people are starting to figure out what grows where. It's been almost 40 years that grapes have been in the Santa Ynez Valley in the modern time, and we had missions as well. So back in the 1800s, there was mission grapes there. But this is real viticulture now, and it's kind of fun. And we're doing some decent wine now, too.
So when the winery first started, when you look at all the places you could go,
up and down the coast. I mean, was it specific to Syrah and that particular varietal?
No, absolutely not. We started in 73 and planted the usual suspects, of which Syrah was not one of them.
Okay. Well, now back then, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was no Syrah. We planted the first Syrah in Santa Barbara County in 78, so 5 years after we started planting some of the other things. And we actually planted it kind of as a lark and wanted to see how it'd do in a blend. There was only 90 acres of Syrah in the whole state of California at that point.
Wow. And that's changed a little bit.
Yeah, that's changed. It's now 18,000 acres. I noticed.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. So we started playing. And at that time, you know, we made White Zinfandel. We had Riesling. Our 78 Riesling got a gold medal in the L.A. wine competition. And so we figured out, you know, we basically planted one of everything to see what would work. And over the years, we found out what works. And to me, I always thought, you know, you got to kind of listen to Mother Nature. And we were the first ones in the neighborhood planting grapes. Sanford and Benedict planted about 2 years before us. And they're a good 15 miles inland. They planted Chardonnay and Pinot. And from our locations, we could learn a little, but not a lot. I mean, we had Pinot Noir and Chardonnay on our property originally, too, but too hot for Pinot and too cold for Cabernet is what it turned out to. And to me, you got to listen to Mother Nature. Mm. And you can't learn just in 1 year. It doesn't work that way. It takes 3 years to get a grape. It takes, you know, another 2 years to get really good wine, decent wine. And then you got to say, well, is it just vintage variation, farming variation, you know, those kinds of, you know, things. And then, okay. So for us, by the early 90s, we kind of figured out we had something with Syrah after about 12 years growing Syrah and 20 years of growing some of the other things that, you know, Cabernet, I'd ripen up once every 5 years. It was decent. And Zinfandel, it was great for White Zinfandel, but not good for Red Zinfandel. So kind of learn, and you listen to Mother Nature. I learned a long time ago, you learn to listen to women, because even when you think you, like, want to fight, you actually lost. I've been married to the same woman for 21 years, so it seems to work so far. But always listen to women. They usually know what they're talking about. Mother Nature is no exception to that.
That's why I'm a single guy, Brooke. Yeah, and it would be a very different place if all these things happened in a year. But, of course, it doesn't work that way. And Mother Nature doesn't work that way. The vines don't work that way. But you are fairly diverse from what I can see. You do Viognier. You do a couple of other things. A Zegris. I'm just looking at that. So tell me about your wines.
Yeah, we actually are down to just 8 varieties on the property. Which is great. I like to keep things simple because I can't keep it all straight. Mm. So Zegris is our rosé wine, a dry rosé that we do. Sell it mostly just out of the tasting room. People say rosé is on the way back, and it is here and there, but not everywhere. So I'll believe it when I see it. We do have Viognier. We just planted, about 10 years or 5 years ago now, planted some Grenache Blanc, which is kind of fun to play with. We have Roussanne. Lovely white wine, which is great. A big, rich white wine. And then Grenache, Mourvèdre, Syrah, and those are our grapes.
Ooh,
I'm gonna go Chardonnay. I got a little Chardonnay, too.
I want to go back to that one. You're growing Mourvèdre.
Yes.
That's really interesting, because I've not met anybody down that way that does, and maybe other people are. I'm not aware of it, and I'm a fan of Mourvèdre, the grape. So what brought you that? Is it a naturally good area for that?
We found out that it is.
Yeah.
It's we're doing some different things with it. Over the years, it's usually our last ripener. We usually pick it on Halloween or, you know, the first week in November, which is kind of scary. But Mourvèdre is a late ripener, so we've changed some of the viticulture. We planted a new block in 08, tighter spacing, and actually lowered the cordon. The cordon's where the vine kind of goes horizontal to the ground, and lowered it about 6 inches from our normal height. And we're thinking just that closer to the dirt where the warmth is, maybe a degree or two more per day. But you add that up over a 150-day growing cycle, that can actually make things improve. Plus, the smaller vines or tighter spacing has the vines will have less fruit on it. So we're hoping that that can ripen up earlier.
And correct me if I'm wrong, that is a smaller berry, isn't it?
It can be.
Okay. In this case, is it, or just
smaller than what?
Well, I guess a Cabernet. I mean,
yes. Yeah. Smaller. Most of the Rhone varieties seem to be smaller than the Cabernet grapes. Mm-hmm. Usually thicker skins, too.
Okay. And how long ago did you start growing these?
Well, Syrah started in 78 on our property, and then we started planting grapes. We had Chardonnay.
Well, I mean, the Mourvèdre,
was the early 90s.
I was mostly curious about it because even up in the northern part of the state, the other couple of counties that people talk about, I've only found it in Sonoma. I've not seen it anywhere in Napa that I'm aware of anyway. So it's just kind of interesting to see this. And I also, you like when you see somebody taking a risk on a rum varietal, especially in California. It's very cool.
But, you know, Mourvèdre, you won't see much Mourvèdre by itself because it really works well with others. It plays well with others. Grenache is a great friend of his, and it's kind of the yin and the yang where Grenache is bright and fruity while Mourvèdre is kind of earthy and dark and black and brooding kind of thing. And they're a great pair together.
You do bottle it under its own name? Or?
Just a couple cases when we sell it again out of the tasting room. But we do a blend that's Grenache-based, and it's in the market here. It's called Z-Cuvée.
Oh, okay. That was a Z-Cuvée. Okay, I saw that as well.
Yeah. And Z is for, again, for Zaka. It's not Zinfandel or any – it's Zaka.
Definitely not for Zinfandel.
Yeah. No.
Right. Okay. So your official title, other than the big one being CEO, you call yourself the wine grower. I've never heard anybody call themselves that before.
Well, it's just the American version of the – what is it? The French call it vignon. And it's one who's involved in everything, and from stem to stern. You know, you want to see my soil types, that's there on my boots.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm out doing the marketing and sales side of things too. So I have to do it all, which is kind of fun. We're a small organization, and that makes every day a new day. You know, in the vineyard looking at, you know, mite damage or what the cluster counts are going to be, tasting new blends or talking to people in Milwaukee.
A lot of talking going on out there, I'm sure.
Or tasting wine wherever it needs to be. So that's kind of I've taken my fair share of viticulture classes, and I know enough to be dangerous. And I've been around a winery a few years, so I know enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, pretty much get a good idea what's going on around these, what's going in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, with the way the season's been in California in general, I know, again, the more northern part of the state has certainly had issues and quite a bit of loss. How about you guys down that way?
We had that frost in April, which pissed me off. I mean, we had a frost, 3 years ago in April, too, and it's like, oh, it's a 30-year frost. It never happened. So I thought, great, I'm good for another 27 years. Well, it happened again. And it did piss me off. And then I lost about 20 acres of Syrah. I wasn't wiped out, so that's like 10%. I got 200 acres under vine. And then we had rain in June, which, again, California, we never have rain in June. And we were blooming, and so I got a little problem with some of my clusters didn't – or the grapes didn't all pollinate, so I got half clusters kind of thing. I call it shatter on my late bloomer, which, again, was Syrah. So I got the double whammy of the frost and then this. But everything else, it looks good. I mean, the growing season since June has been phenomenal. It's 55 degrees in the morning, a little bit of cool breeze. Sun's shining, and then warms up to about 90 degrees during the day. I'd like to get a little hotter now and then, but it's really cool is our area is it peaks out between 1 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon is when the temperature, maybe, you know, it's 95 degrees maybe for 10 minutes. and then the ocean breezes kick in. You can almost set your watch by it at 3 o'clock every afternoon. The ocean breezes. And by the time I leave at 6 o'clock at night, it's back down to 70 degrees.
Wow, it's amazing.
And unlike you've been up to like Napa Valley, you know, Calistoga is, you know, on a summer day, it's still 105 at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's what Cabernet loves that. Give me the heat.
Very different area.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess looking at what you've dealt with this year, do you think, even though you've had this loss, and this is probably more of an ignorant question, do you think there will be a certain degree of intensity with what survived, that really there might be a little bit of a benefit, less yield, more intense flavor?
That's what we saw in 08 as well, is the more intensity. But also what I've noticed about the 08s is approachability too. So there's intensity, but approachable too. The tannins are really integrated, not harsh or sticking out, which is good because sometimes the tannins can also be pretty bold in those lighter vintages.
Overall, what's your output in your winery?
Again, depends on Mother Nature. Anywhere from 30,000 to 40,000 cases.
Okay, so you're a pretty respectable size then.
Yeah, too big to be boutique and too small to for anybody to really care about. You know, so I'm in no man's land.
Yeah,
but we're in 45 states across the U.S. and I'm doing some stuff in Canada, Japan, and Northern Europe.
Has Japan become a big market for you?
It's I don't know about big, but it's starting to chug along nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Just got another 100 case order out of them, so I'm happy about that.
That's good, especially considering what's happened in the last year. It's
kind
of frightening. I know a lot of wineries I talk to, the Asian market has become huge for them, but of course after the earthquake, the market just dropped, right?
Yeah.
Which of course makes sense. Mm-hmm. Me, I'd be drinking more wine just to try and survive it, but yeah, that's just me. I wanted to talk about the 8-barrel Syrah. I saw that on your website, and it just I'm a big Syrah guy, and just something about that's a very appealing name. So tell me about that.
It is actually more of a barrel test than anything else. Again, we make a couple hundred cases of it, and what we do is we line up. It's usually 8. Could be more. Could be less. Different coopers, so different barrel types, different barrel makers, and we'll put the same block of Syrah. And we'll use it as, okay, how are the each of different Cooper's barrels doing with our wine? And then so we test more for educational. And as we've been redeveloping our vineyard over the last 10 years because the old stuff was getting old and tired. So we've been planting, we've probably ripped up half the 250 acres we have and replanted most of it. So we have to go through and almost recalibrate our barrel, our Cooper's, because of the new blocks come on, have new personalities and things like that. So it's a great way to test how the coopers are adjusting or how we have to find the right barrels for the right blocks, basically, is what we're doing. So we go through and do a barrel test, and then we can figure out what the individual components are, and then we blend it all together and put it in. And it's so different because it's all new oak, which we don't do a lot of new oak in our wines. And it goes back to one of my philosophies is we are all estate-grown fruit. And I'm a terroirist, not a terrorist. I'm sure you've heard that before. I stole that from somebody else. But I believe that where you grow something makes it unique. So you need to preserve and protect your uniqueness. And part of that uniqueness is making sure that you don't cover it up with a bunch of new oak that anybody else could buy.
Sure, right.
So that's kind of we try to make sure the fruit is prominent in all our wines. And the oak, there's an oak component, yes, but it's not – you're not getting splinters on your tongue when you're drinking our wine.
Right. That's great. So it's somewhat of a marketing thing.
Well, it's efficiency because I got to sell the wine I make.
Right, which makes good sense.
I'm not going to bulk it off to sell it to somebody else. So I got to figure out a way to – it is a little bit of a marketing thing because here's a barrel test that we have to have to make all our wines better. And I end up with 400 cases that I've got to figure out what to do with. So that's kind of how it ended up.
That was poor choice of words on my part. I was just trying to come up with an end of day type thing. That's my cheap excuse. And I haven't had any wine yet. So you do, I believe, what, 3 different Syrahs? Is that correct?
We're up to 4 now, including the 8-barrel. So we have our estate Syrah, which most of the market sees a lot of. And we do a good fair amount of that, anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 cases. And that's what we're probably most known for. We do a new, we're on our second vintage of our Mesa Reserve Syrah, which we just started. It's from a new block we planted in 04. And it's so different. I mean, the guys in the cellar basically named it as, it's from the Mesa block. We call it Mesa, and we reserved it off to the side because we didn't know what to do with it. And it's like, oh, okay. So it's Mesa Reserve. That's the marketing genius that I am.
Clever.
Yeah, exactly. The 8-barrel, which we just talked about. And then we do a, it's called Black Bear Block Syrah. It's the original block of Syrah we planted in 78. It's on its own roots, and it gets its name actually because we do still get black bears run through the vineyard eating the grapes and
I would say I'd let them eat the grapes pretty much and not deal with them otherwise.
Yeah.
So that's a real problem for you out there.
It's a rare sighting. We see one or two a year.
Hmm.
And they're just as scared of us as we are of them, so it works out well.
I think there's a difference in percentage, is my guess, of how much the fear. I can only speak from my personal experience, having never run into a bear. You've got this issue with bears. Are you having any problems with wild hogs at all? Because I'm reading about that in Texas and certainly in California.
Yes, we do. We get a lot of issues with hogs, and that's actually, it's more wild pigs. Mm. They're not the ones with the big tusks or anything like that. They're just wild pigs. They eat the grapes. They go through the they basically ruin my deer fence. They put holes in the deer fence so then the deer come in. And then they dig through some of the irrigation and things like that. Otherwise, but we have some friends that come through and kind of clean out the population now and then. And then we have carnitas. It's great. We have a barbecue.
Well, but there is an advantage to it, isn't there?
Exactly. But it is what I'm learning is the cycle's kind of funny. You get a heavy rain year. The following year, we get a heavy acorn year because there's a lot of oak trees. The following year after that is a big pig year. And then the next year is we get a lot of mountain lions. So it's a great cycle where – and it all makes sense. And I was up middle of the day up in the vineyard, and it wasn't a mountain lion. It was a bobcat. But it was still – it was 11:30 in an open field, and
– I'd rather deal with the acorns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's bobcat, and it's like, hello.
Yeah. So what did you do? Just kind of like
– I stopped my truck and let it walk by.
Sure. Well,
thanks for playing.
well, you know, you got mountains there, and that's what's going to happen.
It's great about California is there's still plenty of rural space. We back up to one of those, wilderness areas behind us.
So they're coming down into your area, is that what you're saying? Because what are you at altitude-wise roughly where you're at?
We're at 1,500 feet.
Oh, so you're up there a bit then.
Yeah.
Okay, so that makes sense because I know the hogs also like the hills as well. Mm-hmm. So they just kind of come down and hang out, and I'm sure you probably get an occasional snake or two, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's still a very safe place for people to come visit. I should say that because this is just more the entertainment end of this thing for people like me who don't have to deal with it as opposed to people like you who have to work with this. And of course, you got workers you're responsible for out there.
Absolutely.
You certainly don't want anybody getting hurt.
Safety is very important to us.
Yeah.
Much so.
Yeah. You'd mentioned the acorns. Is that a problem for you in terms of the growing season? You said, you know, you have mountain lions one year and you got the hogs. Is acorns any kind of an issue or?
No, it's just
– Well, that was a dumb question then pretty much.
No, just watching nature around you because our estate, our piece of property is 750 acres and we can only farm about 250 of it. So that other 500 is watershed, hillsides, sagebrush, and oak trees and animals. So and it's just too steep and unsafe to really farm anyways. And you need some space for – nature to exist. So it is, it's interesting just to watch, you know, watch the cycles of the estate, you know, of that piece of land and the vegetation and wildlife coming and going and seeing how things impact each other and trying not to, you know, be in the middle of that.
Right.
We are in the middle of it, but not trying to influence it one way or another.
Which is a challenge because you are working with, I mean, everything is about wine is all Mother Nature in essence. And these are the cards you've been dealt. You're playing them the best you can. Every winemaker, every owner I get a chance to talk to, I ask this question too, so I'm going to ask you. Corks versus caps.
Corks.
Okay, we're done, Tim. Turn us off. Thanks. So, okay, anything you want to talk about with that? I'm curious.
I'm a traditionalist, and, you know, I got a line too for you is, you know, I want people talking about my wine, not my package. So, it's a traditional. I think, especially with the Rhone wines, the Syrah in particular, they need air because they can get reductive. They can get stinky. They age. And the way we make wine, we're very traditional. You know, we don't strip stuff out. We don't add stuff to make it approachable or market ready. It's market ready when it tastes good. And the evolution in the bottle is a key component for us for that aging. That's the way we make wine. We could change the way we make wine dramatically and then put a screw top on it because then at that point you basically have to say the wine's ready to drink at that point because it's not really going to evolve that much. So We use the bottle as the next phase of aging our wine in the development flavor.
So you're making it very clear what kind of wine you're selling, that it is going to be ageable, that kind of a thing. And from what I can see, too, your prices are very reasonable, too. So was the Reserve, I just want to go down that real quick, was the Reserve more of an expensive wine? Or?
Yeah, the Reserve's about 40, 45 bucks a bottle retail, and then the Black Bear is about 60.
Mm-hmm. Still pretty reasonable, though.
Yeah. I mean, nothing's – yeah. It's Syrah, too. I mean, there's not – we can't get the Cabernet's King because it gets the highest
California.
Price. Yeah.
Yeah, what can you do about that? So just a little bit more about you because we really haven't talked about you that much. Somewhere along the line, I assume you were bitten by a bug called wine. How'd that happen?
It goes back to girls, women. Yeah. In college, I kind of – well – you know, beer guzzlers wasn't very attractive to a lot of the girls that I were attracted to. And so, and they drank wine. So it's like, well, I better figure out what this thing is. So got bitten by that bug. And
it's either wine or rock and roll, I guess. That's how it works.
Exactly. So, and ever since then, learning more and more about wine. And came out of college and it's like, well, I want to, you know, work for a company that I kind of like what they do, like their product. You got to have, you know, there's got to be a passion for what. So I'm a CPA by training, so which wasn't very passionate. So I got my that was a means to an end. So I got my CPA license, and then I this was up in Reno, and then worked at a ski resort, worked at Heavenly Valley Ski Resort. I was a controller there for a couple of years because I loved to ski. And skied a lot and
smart.
Met my wife and then found this little winery down at a family-owned winery down in Modesto, owned by two brothers, and started working there. Ernest and Julio, have you ever heard of them?
I think I've heard of them somewhere along the line, yeah.
Yeah. Great. Talk about a great learning experience. They sent me to MBA school. They moved me all over the place. I did finance. I did marketing. I did sales.
What year would that have been, roughly?
I started at Gallo in 89.
So you really got some pretty serious experience there.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, which really carries over to the size of what you're selling here, too. I mean, it's certainly not Gallo.
Yeah.
But it still is not not a boutique winery.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. And then spent 8 years at Gallo, then 5 years at Behringer, and learned a lot about fine wine and Napa wine and all those kind of fun things. At that point, I was on the marketing side of things there. Great time. And as soon as the beer guys came in, I left.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big difference then. Were you working with Ed Sobrazzi then?
Yes, I was.
What an awesome guy.
Ah.
And Tor, was he still there?
Tor was still there.
Yeah, another great guy. Two guys who I love to death.
It was 96 to basically 2000, and that was the magic. Everybody throughout that organization. I mean, it was like an all-star team coming together, and it was so much fun. We could do no wrong. It was a lot of fun.
It was definitely not doing. There was it was perfection. It was great.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, Behringer did a lot for the wine business just by simple fact of White Zinfandel.
Yeah.
Introduced people into what wine was all about, or at least starting it off before they started learning about the better stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried Tor's or Ed's wines at all?
I've had Ed's. Tor's are usually too expensive.
Yeah,
I can't
me
afford
too.
That.
Yeah. But Ed's stuff is, man, he's making some damn fine stuff. It cracked me up that he went over to Sonoma, though. I thought, how weird after
all
these years.
Well, he's always lived there.
Oh, I didn't know he lived there back then. Oh, cool.
Where you grow up makes you unique. And I don't think people think, oh, it's California wine. But California is a big state. And there's a lot of difference between wine up north, where most people understand. And we're a good 350 miles from Napa, south. And actually, I think we're not as far. We're actually east.
Almost southeast.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But we're north and west of L.A.
Which is really weird now. Well, yeah.
Because
the state curves in.
Bends around.
Right, like Mexico does, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and we're about an hour outside of the town of Santa Barbara.
Well, the big thing, too, is – you know, you have a tasting room there and people can come visit. And it's not by appointment, right? You can just walk in.
Just walk in.
And that's something people should know because, a lot of people go to Sonoma and Napa, but the whole Santa Barbara County area is a really great area. And of course, that's where they shot Sideways.
But there's we do have over 100 wineries in Santa Barbara County now, which I look back at some of the research on Santa Barbara. And in 1900, the Santa Barbara was the third largest wine-producing county in California.
Hmm.
We now have less than 4% of the grape acreage. So that means we have very little of what it is. And originally Santa Barbara, most of the wine that was made in Santa Barbara wasn't really made in Santa Barbara. The grapes were shipped north to the big boys, and it was blended into California wines. So that's why you still don't see a lot of Santa Barbara wines. Of the 18,000 acres in Santa Barbara County, half of it's owned by Kendall Jackson or Behringer with Meridian.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of, even today, there's a lot of grapes that get blended out to other things, or they stay, hopefully they stay Santa Barbara County or Santa Maria so you don't get that much wine out of our three appellations or county-wise because it gets blended with other things. So when you do find it, please support us.
There you go. All the more reason to come visit the area, to see somewhere that's less traveled, probably a little less congested, and from what I understand, very welcoming, very friendly.
It is.
How can our listeners find out about you on the web?
That newfangled web is great. It is zacamesa.com. Very simple.
Great. And that's spelled with a C, just to be clear on that, Zaca.
Z-A-C-A-M-E-S-A.
Great.
And we're also on Facebook.
Terrific. Even better.
Yeah.
Great. Again, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To learn more about Zaca Mesa, go to zacamesa.com.
Thanks for listening to this program. Watch for our next podcast in December, which feature Michael Dash of Dash Cellars in Oakland, California, and John Benish and his daughter Nell Sikora of Benessery Wines in Napa, California. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines is produced by Ray Pfister. Post-production was completed at Fifth Floor Recording Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Edited by Ray Pfister and Dustin Harmon. Original music composed by Tim Turton. Narrated by Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photography by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2011.